This all makes sense. And yes, I just started the recording now. Barnyard animal nightmares. All right. Taken in isolation, the story of Ruth is an incredible story about three main characters, Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz, who are doing everything they can to sacrifice for each other. And if you remember, that kind of starts in chapter one. It's the theme that gets brought out in chapter two, chapter three, and chapter four, with the culmination of Boaz taking a Moabite woman as his first-class wife, as an Isha. And you have this incredible story about sacrificing for those in your life, taking care of others at a potential expense to yourself. And when you read the book of Ruth without any sort of background information, without any sort of circumstances that we're going to go over today, especially in the political realm, it's a wonderful theological story about people loving each other. Mm-hmm. And that's great. But we got to go deeper than that, because I think if you start unlocking the levels of political rhetoric that's happening in this book, it can lead to a deeper understanding of not only what the story is trying to accomplish theologically and politically, but a deeper lesson that God may be trying to send through the book. Okay, so I want to set the stage again in Deuteronomy 23, and here are the stakes. Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, no Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord to the 10th generation. None of their descendants shall ever do so. And what did the author of Ruth do every time the word Ruth was mentioned? Right, and there were times, especially in chapter 4, when Boaz was speaking, he would say Ruth the Moabite from Moab. Right, like it's a designed way of describing Ruth so that you never quite forget as the story progresses where she is from, right? And so to put it in context of what's going on historically, I think we need to talk about how David ascends to the throne. Who was the first king over Israel? Saul, right? And you remember, it's a great story about them anointing this like handsome, brave dude who wound up hiding among the luggage. You remember this story? Fascinating tale about character. However, in the book of Ruth, we have a man named Elimelech. Who remembers what that word means? God, Melech is king. God is my king, right? God is my king dies. And what is the very last word in the book of Ruth? David. So we have this political story about David. And it looks like it's an attempt to justify David's ascendance to the throne, because we have this Saul character who is on the throne, who has children of his own. And yet you've got this shepherd guy who's coming from Bethlehem, who's most well known for battling a giant, who says, hey, swearsies, when I was a kid, Samuel, before he died, showed up and anointed me with oil. And I am the chosen one. Okay, that's problematic on several levels, right? At the very least, on the most surface of all levels, David looks like he's attempting a military coup, taking over the throne that's not rightfully his, at least not the way that thrones passed down in the ancient world. But we've also got this problem because of who David is related to. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that this story is one that is repeated often, especially in Bethlehem. The story of Ruth is something that's told over and over and over and over again, right? It's structured as a play. It's very easy to tell. It's very short. It's very sweet. There's some awesome morals. No one is forgetting that there's a Moabite in this guy's blood. So how do I justify when the book of Deuteronomy says no descendants to the 10th generation can enter the assembly of the Lord? How do I justify a guy who's got Moabite blood, who was anointed in secret when he was a kid, ascending to the throne? And do you remember the anointing scene? You remember it? 1 Samuel 16. Uh-huh. It's a beautiful scene. I'm going to start in verse 4 for the sake of expediency. Samuel did what the Lord had told him. When he arrived in Bethlehem, the elders of the city were afraid to meet him because more often than not, Samuel showed up announcing judgment. And they literally walk out to him and say, "Do you come in peace? We're sorry." He replied, "Yes, in peace, I've come to sacrifice the Lord. Consecrate yourselves, come with me to the sacrifice." So he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. And when they arrived, Samuel noticed Eliab, and he said to himself, "Surely here before the Lord stands the chosen king." This guy looks like a king. But the Lord said to Samuel, and this is the key verse for our lesson today, "Do not be impressed by his appearance nor his height, for these I have rejected. God does not view things the way that people do. People look on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." God doesn't look at the outer appearance. God is the one who's looking at the heart. Okay, so what do we know about the hearts of those who were involved in the story of Ruth? Well, it seems like their hearts are in a place where they're sacrificing for each other, especially our three main characters. And there's this relationship between the three of them. Naomi, remember, means pleasant. She had turned her name to Moab, which means bitter. At the very end of the story, Ruth and Boaz have a child named Obed, who is called Naomi's Redeemer. You remember this last week where we talked about how the text literally says the child was born to Naomi, even though the child wasn't born to her. We've got this beautiful story of people whose hearts are in the right place. Does this make sense? Okay. So Ruth, which means friendship, and Boaz, which means strength. And you can tell me if I'm wrong about this, since this is your field. The bet at the beginning sometimes means like in. Is that right? So there are some commentators who think that the name Boaz mean in the Lord's strength. All commentators are agreed that there's something about strength that is Boaz's name. And they come together and they have a child named Obed, who means the one who serves. So I don't want to make too much of this theologically, but perhaps a heart based on friendship combined with strength leads to service. Obed winds up taking care of Naomi more than Naomi takes care of Obed, even though Naomi is called the child's caregiver. Obed, of course, has a son named Jesse. Jesse winds up having a son named David. And so this is David's family. Elsewhere in 1 Samuel, David is called a man after God's own heart, yes? By the way, David is not called a man after God's own heart because David was righteous. We know he's not. He's not a good person. He's just as flawed and messed up as the rest of us. That Bathsheba incident, it's pretty messed up from start to finish. And so David is called a man after God's own heart, not because of who he looks like, not because of the things that he's done. He's called a man after God's own heart because of the condition of his heart. And that seems to be Samuel's point in 1 Samuel 16 when he's anointing David. When God says to him, "Look, I don't care what people look like. I care about the content of their character. I care about what's coming out of their heart." And perhaps, this whole Moabite thing, perhaps there's something bigger than just where you came from or the ethnicity of your ancestors or the culture that you were raised in. You remember that promise that Ruth makes to Naomi in chapter 1, "Where you go, I will go. Where you die, I will die. Your God will be my God. Your people will be my people." No matter what God says about Moabites in Deuteronomy chapter 3, it surely seems like friendship's heart is in the right place, yes? And perhaps there's something bigger than simply following the letter of the law, but instead understanding the spirit of the law, right? This is a branch of theology that Jesus is going to bring out, especially in the Sermon on the Mount, and we'll get to that in 1 second. But the author of Ruth is fully aware of who Ruth is, fully aware of the problem in Deuteronomy 23, and fully aware that Obed technically is not Boaz's child legally. You remember this from last week. technically Obed and all the legal language is supposed to be Mahlon's child. Because of how levirate marriage works in Deuteronomy 25, he is supposed to be recognized as Mahlon's child legally for the sake of inheritance, for the sake of property rights, for the sake of things passing down from one generation to the next. And anytime we read a genealogy, this kid should be listed as the son of Mahlon. Because that's how legal orders or legal... Oh, I'm blanking on the word. Here's my brain fart. Whatever. Thank you. Yeah. It's how legal rights were recognized. Okay? And at the very end of Ruth, look at your genealogy. At the very end of Ruth, Boaz is listed as Obed's father. Okay? So we have two possible options. Either the author of Ruth made a mistake, or they're doing something deeper by mentioning Boaz as the father of Obed instead of the legally recognized father of Boaz, or of Obed, who should be Mahlon. Let's just eliminate the possibility that it's a mistake by reading Matthew chapter 1. There's another genealogy that makes this same decision. There seems to be a purposeful decision-making in the genealogy in the Old Testament, which names Boaz as Obed's father instead of Mahlon. In the New Testament, the exact same decision is made. I'm going to read it real fast. This is the record of genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, who is the son of Abraham. Abraham, the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Matthew lists a woman's name in a male-based genealogy for two reasons. One, he wants you to remember how messed up this family is that Jesus is coming from. But two, it's Matthew's kind of way of saying, hey, go back and read that story. The story matters for who Jesus is and what Jesus is trying to do. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nahshon. Nahshon, the father of Salma. Salma, the father of Boaz by Rahab. And Boaz was the father of Obed. And then look, we've got Ruth mentioned here, by Ruth. And then Obed was the father of Jesse. Jesse, the father of David the king. And so we have two distinct genealogies that were written several hundred years apart, both not making a mistake. This seems to be a purposeful move. One, we're not afraid of mentioning Ruth. We are not afraid to mention that there's Moabite blood in David the king. There's Moabite blood in this Jesus character. We're not afraid of that. And the second thing is, there seems to be a purposeful remembrance of Boaz. And this really matters for how chapter 4 plays out. Do you remember Poloni Almoni is talking about how scared he is that his name is going to be blotted out from memory? That same risk applies to Boaz too, that his name would be blotted out from memory if the only son he ever had was Obed, because technically Obed's not his child legally. And yet Boaz's name gets remembered. And I'm going to add another wrinkle to how often this story is told. Does anybody in here know where the name Boaz shows up in the books of Chronicles? Anybody know? Solomon names one of the pillars of the original temple Boaz. Names it after his, great-grandfather? Great-great-grandfather? And the way that construction is made, it seems to suggest that Solomon has been told this story. It seems to suggest then that David has been told this story over and over again. This became a family story. Here's how we got to Bethlehem. Here's how amazing this family is. Here's a story about love and sacrifice and the rest of it. And so at the very least, there seems to be a purposeful move on the parts of these biblical authors to say, God cares more about the content of our character, the content of our heart, than he does our outer appearance, the things that we're known by, the ethnicity, the culture, the rest of it. That there seems to be a purposeful move on God's part as his spirit is directing scriptural authority and how the scriptures are written. There seems to be a purposeful move where God, dare I say it, ignores some of the things that were legally done at the time for a bigger purpose. Is everybody with me on this? I'm struggling to find the right words to this because my brain, like I said, is not firing. But the move in the genealogy would seem to suggest that both the author of Ruth and the author of Matthew are fully aware of how the genealogy should work, but they're choosing to remember Boaz instead. Yes, ma'am.
This is not the way my translation reads, but I thought when you were reading the genealogy in Matthew, each one, it said so-and-so was the father of so-and-so. But when you got to Obed, you read something like, and to Boaz was born Obed. Is there something in the way that not being the father of, like everybody else was the father of somebody, when you got to
My translation is Boaz, the father of Obed, by Ruth. I don't have the to born to. Hey, Chuck, would you mind pulling up a Greek translation real fast? Thank you. Okay.
Maybe legally that would indicate maybe that it was an adoption or something different.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. This is a weird defense of an ascendancy to the throne. Right? If this is political rhetoric, normally when someone in the ancient world is seizing power, there's a presentation or a defense of seizing power that goes along the lines of, like, look, this guy is mightier than the rest of the people. He's a better leader than the rest of the people. He's going to carry us to victory in all these battles. When somebody's seizing power in the ancient world, a lot of times there is some sort of divine right mentioned. But in David's case, the defense for his ascendancy to the throne in the story of Ruth seems to be the reason that David's justified in taking power is because of who his family was. That this seems to be what it looks like to be a person after God's own heart. That this seems to be what God is looking for when he looks in the heart. Not a life based on selfish ambition, but a life based on sacrifice for those around us. A life where we think of others more than we think of ourselves. A life, dare I say it, where loving the Lord our God with all our mind, soul, strength, and spirit might lead to loving our neighbors. If I can paraphrase somebody else. Always. By the way, this strand of theology, of caring more about the content of the heart than the actual technical legal issue, is exactly what Jesus has in mind in Matthew 5 when he says over and over and over again, you have heard it said, do not murder. But I tell you, and I'm going to paraphrase this, take care of the anger problem in your heart, and if you do, you're not going to kill somebody. You have heard it said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you, take care of the lust problem in your heart, because if you take care of the lust problem, you're never going to cheat on your spouse. He says this over and over and over again in the hopes of teaching those who are following him, don't get so caught up in the legal I's and T's and the rest of it, that you miss the fact that God gave you the law because he's concerned about the content of your heart. That's what Jesus is after too. And so we have a story that is a fascinating defense of who David is. Not based on the things he's done, not based on the things he's accomplished. In 1 Samuel 16, it's about his heart. And in the story of Ruth, it's, hey, let me tell you about the kind of family that raises a kid after God's own heart. Let me tell you what a family looks like whose content of heart is what God is after. Let me tell you the story of this guy's family, a story that is clearly told over and over and over again, a story that's so important to Matthew that Ruth is one of four women that makes Jesus' genealogy. And that seems to be what the point of Ruth is. It's a play. And again, I think reading it like a play, it's not like this was a story that was acted out. But looking at it in terms of these four acts, with this plot, this climax, each of us reading it, wondering what's going to happen, watching each of the characters sacrifice everything for each other, loving each other, to the very end, culminating in God providing, and the text says this in chapter 4, God providing a redeemer for Naomi. That Boaz is not Naomi's Goel. Obed is. He gives her purpose. Matthew seems to see this story as instructive for the ultimate redeemer. Yes? And this is not just David's family. This is Jesus' family too. With all the good and the bad baggage that we read in the Old Testament, this is Jesus' family too. This is the kind of family he comes from. And Matthew, at the very least, seems to say, hey, go back and read this other story about a baby who's born in Bethlehem who becomes a redeemer. Because we're going to tell another story about an ultimate redeemer who's born as a baby in Bethlehem too. So here's where I want to end. I think I did everything. Did I tell the definition of Boaz and Obed? Forgive me. It's going to be one of those. Perfect. Server or service. Servant. Yeah.
What's Malon's name?
Sickly.
So sickly versus strength.
Yeah, and I don't want to make too much of sickly versus strength because Malon's brother Kilion, remember his name was Frail. So sick and frail die in chapter 1. I'm sorry, what?
She wasn't then.
Yeah. I don't know. You know how a lot of times kids were in, especially in the Old Testament, were named by something related to how they were born, right? Like Isaac's name means laughter because Abraham and Sarah laughed at God. What's his name? Esau means hairy. Jacob used to mean grabber of the heel because of how those two boys were born. So perhaps they just came out and they were sick and frail. And you know, now we're talking. They went to whatever version of the NICU existed in Bethlehem at the time. God looks at the content of my heart more than he does where I came from. More than he does the ethnicity of my ancestors. God cares more about the content of my heart. And even the strictest legal instructions in Deuteronomy are superseded by God caring about the heart. And that seems to be one of the main theological points of this book. That even something as strong as no Moabite can enter the assembly of the Lord until the 10th generation, God's caring about the character and content of the heart is more important than that. So I'm going to turn y'all loose in discussion. And I'm going to ask the question this way. So if all of that is true, everything we've been doing in here for the last 5 or 6 weeks, however long we've been en route, in your mind, two questions. One, why is the book named Ruth? Why is the book named after that particular character? In kind of corresponding with that, and what is that supposed to teach us? What is the point of doing that supposed to bring out in us? Is everybody with me on this? Right, because this is not a book named something like In Defense of David's Ascendancy to the Throne. Book's not named Boaz either. Book's not named How to Turn Someone from Bitter to Pleasant. The book is named after Ruth. Tell me why. Okay, bye-bye.